Hello, my name is Cornell Green, and I am the Failure Guy. Welcome to the podcast. On this episode of the Failure Guy podcast, my guest is once again Ralph Watkins, founder of the NASCS. Ralph, thanks for joining us, and welcome back to the conversation.
Hey, thanks so much, Cornell. Great to be here. Love the first half, and I've been looking forward to coming back and finishing our conversation.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And for those who are just joining us, please go back and listen to part one of this conversation. So enthralling and exciting. And where when last we met on last week's episode, we were basically, you know, not cheery, but we were kind of at the nadir of your story. We were at the lowest ebb. You had gone from a very successful private mortgage business that was thriving during the bustling end of the first decade of this century. And then suddenly, as we all know, the subprime mortgage meltdown happened, you know, things went belly up, and you went from, you know, a very successful business to, you know, what does it say here? You know, to complete basically chaos. just complete chaos, crashing, you know, a failure. And as we left last week, you were talking about the reluctance to, you know, a friend had suggested that you file for unemployment. And the thing is, I was reviewing the notes from last week. They weren't saying apply for welfare or food stamps or public assistance. They were saying for unemployment to cover what this could, because you had done the work and now things are. But you, something in you was so resistant to that, that your friend had to ask you for the information and file on your behalf. And then you realized, although it wasn't much, it was at least able to put some food in the fridge and some food in the plates on the table.
Exactly.
So let's go to that point. What was going on inside of you that had you so reticent to apply for something that you were totally entitled to?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that something
was,
in the fiber of you.
Well, you know, in my mind, I did equate that with being with signing up for welfare, basically. You know, that was all it all came under one heading of government assistance.
Mm.
Right? People who can't do for themselves. People who take handouts. And so we've all seen people who are now they're second and third generation of welfare. It's like, well, why get a job? Government's paying for it. I don't have to work, you know? So it's like that whole mindset just really, and he's like, no. You got the wrong, this is like insurance that you've been paying for that insures against this exact situation to make sure that you've at least got something to eat, if nothing else, right? And you've paid for it, you've earned it. Shut up, give me that computer. If you won't do it, I'm doing it, you know?
Wow.
So, so that's kind of what was going on inside my head. But even doing that and going, okay, yeah, it's buying groceries. And although I was reluctant, I was hungry, right? So, okay, fine, I'll take the groceries, but I'm still not happy about it, you know? And I had started to tell you before that these tapes were playing in my head, the voices that were inside my head, frankly, they were not kind. They were accusatory, and I just remember I would meet people. I'd be trying to do different things, and I go, "Hey, how are you? I'm Ralph," and then silently in my head, I'd finish that with, you know, that guy with the $42 million bankruptcy petition that lost $4.5 million in personal assets, the failure. Yeah, that Ralph. Right.
Okay.
It would finish that playing in my. Now, of course, I didn't say that part out loud.
Right. But you were like, saying it in your head.
I was saying it in my head. Yeah. And so there was a specific event, and it was just one of those defining moments. We were at a business conference. I was there with a buddy of mine. I reference him in my book. I had unwittingly helped him out of a situation that was completely different in nature, and I would say worse than what I was going through. I didn't understand what it was for him until later, but he's like, dude, you saved my life, my marriage. I'm like, I did. He was just some guy I kind of knew at church and thought I was offering a little quick helping hand, right? So you never know how the Lord's going to use you, how God's going to use you in different situations. And he said, listen, I got this thing. You see, it's like when you play hockey, you don't go to where the puck is, you skate to where the puck is going to be, right? And where the puck is going to be for right in the mortgage business is coaching loan officers, because there's going to be a tidal wave of people who are drowning and will be looking for good coaching, and that's what we can give. And you're the one who helped me get started, and you're just the person to help me do it, right? So we're doing it, and you're doing this with me. That was his offer, and my response was, brother, that'll just be another reason for somebody to be mad at me. Like, that's all I could see. It was like I was having a PTSD moment from my, when you file bankruptcy, you have a 341 hearing. That's when you go in and you sit before the trustee and they just kind of review your stuff and go, and usually there's nobody there. You file bankruptcy, you go, it's you and it's the trustee. But no, in my situation, the room was full of people. It was all my investors who had been buying loans from me, and now they're all upside down, and they're defaulted, and they're right. And look, who are they gonna be upset with? There's nobody else for them to be upset with but me. And interesting, my wife points this out. She goes, we're really, really big on the five love languages. We've taught it a number of times to at churches and different couples and stuff. She goes, 100%, your primary love language is words of affirmation. So I'm flashing back to sitting in this 341 hearing, and I got several dozen investors all getting up and taking turns and tell me what a doofus I am. Right? I went from being called visionary to being called a dumbass. And so he goes, hey, I want you to get up, and we're going to. Basically, what I'm hearing is you're going to put yourself out here in front of more people so they can be upset with you if everything doesn't work out just the way you say it's going to. So, it's like Tom Cruise in the movie The 4th of July. When he was a little boy, he watched the World War II vets in the parade, and kids had set off fireworks, and they're in the car, and these World War II vets are flinching at the sound of the fireworks because it's horrible for them. And then when he's grown, he's lost his use of his legs, and he's in the parade, and it's the same exact thing. And now he's the one who's flinching. So
Got it.
my friend says this to me, and mentally I'm flinching, right? So his response to me was great. He goes, brother, you're listening to old tapes. That's what you're doing. And I went, well, that's all I've got right now. So we sort of made our way here and there, and really the turning point for me, and one of the things that got me really back to shed this stuff, was my wife and I got involved in it's a business opportunity. It was one of the network marketing things, but one of their training portions was to they had a subscription to Success Magazine. And so they would send the success. I go, yeah, success, whatever. Yeah. Right. Well, there was a CD included in each one.
Then
Remember
back
what
in the day,
CDs
yes.
are? Yeah, those are the ancient
Yeah, kids, there were
little.
these little round, shiny discs.
So a CD came in, and each one, and it had some interview with somebody who was crushing it, and they're telling their story about how they started from nothing and overcame stuff and failed and overcame more stuff and got setbacks. And you go through there and you go, oh, gosh, each one of those wasn't the end of the universe for him. It wasn't, it was an opportunity to learn what doesn't work and to alter your course and try something different. And each time you make it further, right? So I really, really like it. I didn't realize it was happening, but I just fell in love with listening to these things. And I was driving from Tennessee down to Florida, and this particular day I'm on I-75 in Georgia someplace, and I'm listening to Brian Tracy, the great Brian Tracy, and he's got his book, probably one of my favorites of his was Eat That Frog, And it's about doing the important high payoff activities first.
Ah.
Like if you get up and you know, I got to eat a frog today.
Right.
Don't wait and do it at 4:30 or 4:45 in the afternoon because you're fretting about it all day long.
Right. Exactly.
He said, if you got a frog to eat, get out of bed and go, boom.
Yeah. I have an approach to that. I say do the difficult things first. You know,
that's
first
exactly
of all,
right.
You get it out of the way, and then you get that little dopamine boost of the little victory because you got it done, and everything else is downhill from there.
That's right. Right. And so I'm a student. I was fortunate enough to meet him twice in my life, of the late great Zig Ziglar.
Oh my gosh.
Who spoke about, look, your subconscious it will do whatever you tell you, but it's stupid and it can't tell fact from fiction. It can't tell reality from fantasy. So whatever you focus on, whatever you feed it, it's going to go to work to make that a reality. That's why we need to fill our minds with the good, the clean, the pure, the powerful, and the positive.
Okay.
Right? And so I'm listening to this Brian Tracy, and it just dawned on me, new tapes.
Mm.
So I called up my buddy while I'm driving down the highway. Yo, it's Ralph. Hey, brother, what's going on? Hey, do you remember this conversation? Right. And I told you that. And you said I was listening to old tapes. He goes, yeah, man, I sure do. I said, well, I just wanted you to know I'm listening to new tapes.
Wow.
Dude, that is awesome. And it was like, not only was it a figurative, well, that was old tapes playing and now I'm listening to new tapes. It was a literal. I'm literally listening to new stuff that's reprogramming, that's getting that crap that you're no good, that you're a failure, that, you know, just fold your tent and go get a job or whatever that you hate doing, right? Got all that crap out of my head and back into seeing again the possibilities and mapping out how to make these things that were not a reality, how to make them happen and move toward it like we had done before. That, right. I would say, was one of my biggest turning points. I have a chapter in the book on self-compassion.
Hmm.
Right?
Okay.
And the way that we talk to ourselves sometimes, like,
oh my gosh,
we say stuff to ourselves that we would never say to a friend. So I've been learning to apply what we call the friend rule. It's just, think about it. If a friend came to me and said, man, I had a business, I had a mortgage company, we had this, we had that, and then we got sucked into this giant vortex that happened in 2008, and like we're swept away, and it was like stuff beyond my control, but if a friend was telling you that, would you go, dude, you totally and completely suck? I mean, what a moron. How could you possibly have let that, like,
wow.
You would never say that to a friend.
Right.
You'd go, dude, what are you supposed to do about a worldwide, market
right.
shift? Like,
exactly.
you do the best you can. You navigate it the best you can. You help people the best you can, but you didn't cause it. It wasn't your
right.
fault.
Right.
So what can we learn from that? And how can we move on? And how can I help you? That's what you would say to a friend.
Yes.
And that's what we need to say to ourselves.
True. And I like the way that you phrase it, self-compassion, because I really
yes.
think we treat ourselves worse than we would treat the merest stranger on the street. And you, as we ended last week's episode, you were saying the inner voices in your head and how harsh you were being with yourself. You know,
mm-hmm.
and I think that speaks to where we picked up in this conversation, you know, the reluctance to apply for, as your friend said, this is insurance. That's like saying you're paying the insurance on the full coverage for your car. But then when somebody rear ends you on the highway, you're like, yeah, but I don't want to be dependent on big corporation, the insurance companies. You know what? I can't what take a hammer and a mallet and do the body work on your own vehicle. What are we talking about here? But here in your life, your family, your responsibility, your survival, you know, yeah, but I don't want to. What are we even saying? What are we even telling ourselves? Where do these narratives come from?
That is a great illustration. Yeah, I don't want to use my auto insurance because I think I'm a failure. Even
yeah.
though that's what I bought it. My house burnt down, but I don't want to rebuild it because,
yeah, nah.
You know,
I'll get an axe and, like Paul Bunyan, I'll go chop down trees and hew the lot. What?
Yeah, no.
But that's what.
So,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, so if you know, we spent all that last episode talking about, you know, the rise and the fall, and then, but if you're then to work to find your way out, first you've got to find the floor, you've got to find out what's real, and then determine what is left, what do I have to work with. But part of that is being encouraging to yourself and not demeaning to yourself. It's just like, you know what? It's just like having I am so blessed with a wonderful life partner. I shared with you before off, you know, before we started this, you know, I've been married over 40 years and absolutely, you know, and that's because for that period of time, she's been on my team and not on my back.
Oh, say that again.
Yeah. She's been on my team and not on my back.
On your back. Wow.
So
that's
instead
the t-shirt
of,
right there.
Isn't that a shirt? Because in prior relationship, you can't do that. Like, what do you know about that? Like, how are you going to, yeah, like,
ooh,
sure, as if you could do right. And I'm just like, talk the hand. My wife is like, that's awesome. You could learn that. You're really good at learning this kind of stuff. And man, if you apply what you've done over here to that, you would be incredible. It's like, yeah, I would be incredible, you know? So we need to give ourselves that kind of grace.
Yes.
These are the absolute most rudimentary building blocks to being able to move forward from whatever creek you find up yourself, you know, up.
Yeah.
And be able to move forward from there. Part of it is believing you can, and part of it is encouraging yourself that you can.
Right.
And actually that leads into another one, building a support network.
Mm.
For me, my biggest support network, I think that's habit, is one of the habits, 4 or 5 or something like that. My wife, I'm so blessed, is one of is the pillar of my support network. You know, so like whatever was going on, we went through it together.
Right.
And not, you know, not wearing a scarlet letter of shame for what we had gone through.
Okay. And it's very interesting. I just really want to touch on these distinctions that you talked about, because we touched upon it in the last episode, where you're saying that when you find yourself in a hole, the first thing you got to do is find where the floor is. Like they say, if you find yourself, you're digging a hole, stop digging.
Stop digging.
But first, you got to find out where the bottom is, and then you got to orient yourself and find out which direction is up. How do I get out of here? I don't want to be digging sideways or on an angle. I want to find where up is. But then what you just spoke upon, all of that's great. But if you're not encouraging yourself, you're just going to sit there in the bottom of the hole.
That's right.
You know, where are you going to get the energy to climb out of this hole if all you're doing is taking the dirt and throwing it on top of your head? Okay, so I'm not digging any further, but if I'm just covering myself with dirt, rather than saying, okay, how far is that? What do I need to do? Do I need rest? Do I need nourishment? You know, do I need to, you know, get a grappling hook and whatever have you? And then, of course, self-encouragement is great, but no man is an island. No one does this by themselves. And if you don't have a support team, there's so many people who languish on the side roads of despair, because they have the vision, they have the dream, they have the drive, but they don't have that support. Sometimes you're going to run out of gas. You're not going to have the energy. Like there's the old saying, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, it takes a team.
Yeah.
And that's what you're talking about, to get up out of that hole, because your hole was pretty deep. You know,
deep.
What did you say, $42 million bankruptcy?
Yeah, that was the total petition.
I mean, I can't imagine amassing that much in a lifetime, in several lifetimes. That's the debt.
To be fair here, that I think it needs to be stated that we were a mortgage company,
right?
And on the advice of attorneys, we listed, even though I was not listed as responsible for making the payments,
right?
Because we had set up the loan, we listed all of the outstanding loans that we had created and serviced.
I gotcha. whether you were but, responsible with them or not, this was the totality that came under your company.
That's right.
In one way or another. Got it.
In one way or another. Yeah. Yeah. So that'd be pretty scary if I had somehow. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be horrifying. You know, so now you've got this team. Okay. So how talk us through the journey of how do you get to the point where you talk yourself out of this down talking yourself? How do you shut that inner monologue, that self-defeating, self-bullying? How do you turn that around? How did you turn that around?
So the way I turned it around is you literally, I was going to say physically, but in a physical sense, replace it with real positive input. It's just like, not a political statement. I'm not going in direction. I don't watch the news.
Right. Ditto.
Because it's clickbait designed to get you riled up. And then they feed you a bunch of ads and you buy crap that you don't need.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so you work out doing is blocking out negative inputs. So if there's inputs from something like that, you just go, okay, I'm turn off that news. You're missing something. Look, if something's really important, if an occurrence is really important, it will find you.
Yes.
It will catch up to you.
So exactly.
It will come across your desk in another fashion.
Right.
Okay. Now those negative inputs might not be from the news. They might be from your associations. They might be from people you're hanging out with, which means what? You need to reevaluate whether you're going to stay associating with these people.
Yes.
Because just like we need self-compassion that builds us up, we need that support network that builds us up.
Ah.
And if you're hanging with someone who is a negative Nelly, is Debbie Downer, right? Right.
Yes.
Somebody who's just got a dark outlook on stuff. They're always finding, you know, the Nazi under every bush and you know, all that kind of stuff. It's like, sorry, I'm ending or drastically curtailing my exposure to this individual.
Yes.
And by the way, sometimes that's family. It's not
easy. Oh, yes. Talk about it. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Yeah,
and that can often be the hard part, because of course, especially if we come from a community-based lifestyle, particularly if we're people of faith, the family's like, that's the pillar, that's the ultimate, you know, connection. And to cut off your family, but that's family. It's like, I have a good friend in Wisconsin and we speak several times a week. I call this, you know, as I've said, I'm not a particularly religious person, but I do consider myself a spiritual person, and our conversations, which last for hours at a time, are what I consider my fellowship. And he often has this phrase. He says, say you have a pond, and how do you stop the pond from being poisoned? First of all, stop poisoning the well. And then secondly, pour clean water in. I live here in New York City, and the Hudson River between New York and New Jersey once upon a time was horrifyingly polluted. You knew when you were getting close to the Hudson when you were two or three blocks away because you could smell it.
You could smell it. Ooh.
Yes. Nowadays, there are kayaking in the Hudson River.
What?
Okay. Now, you know the thing about a kayak, you will upend. In fact, the first thing in kayaking is you learn this, you turn yourself upside down and you learn how to flip yourself back up because you're locked in from below the waist in this thing. The first time I saw teams of people learning to kayak, like, wait, in the Hudson? You know, how did that happen? First, they stopped poisoning it.
Yep.
And nature is going to, the equilibrium of nature is as my friend says, also was experiencing some physical difficulty. The natural state is wellness. The natural state of, I believe, the natural state of humanity is peace and ease and community. And as exactly as you're saying this is why I do not watch the news. It's just a curated, I don't care which side of the aisle you're on, it's a curated, you know, documentation of negativity to put you in a state of paralysis, to either listen to the chatter, that's, you know, the party line, or, like you said, and now, since you're depressed anyway, Buy this comfort food, buy these snacks, buy this stuff, buy this, because life sucks anyway, and there's nothing you can do about it. So buy our stuff. This will help you feel better. You know, this will give you the dopamine boost that we just totally depleted by all this depressing stuff. You know, and I walk around my community here in Harlem and I see families together. I see people with their kids, you know, because I work from home. So sometimes I'm walking around and it's oh, wait, it's 3:30, right? School's letting out. And you see the parents walking home, especially with their young kids. And you know that, because you know you have children, that little, like when they're in first or second grade and you pick them up from school. And how was your day? Well, you know, I did this. And then the teacher said that. And then, yeah, and just that togetherness.
Energy.
And I say to myself, this is real life. This is what's actually happening. Not that depressing chatter from the news. And this is not just here. This is all around the world. Yes, there are things that are happening because that's the case, you know. As the saying goes, there have always been poor among you. But this is the real life. And as you're saying, and yes, because I get it, I've been there too. Sometimes if those negative voices are family, you know, you have to say, you know what? Not right now. I love you. You know, in fact, I developed a phrase a couple of years ago. I say, go with God, but not with me.
Or go with God and do it now. Go with God and let me be.
So I like that.
So you're talking about that journey. So part of that is replacing negative influences with positive influences. I said a minute ago, Zig, fill your mind with the good, the clean, the pure, the powerful, the positive. If you do that, your whole outlook changes. You literally feel like a different person. You see, instead of obstacles, you see possibilities.
Yes.
And here's what's really cool. Another one of my habits in the book is that it allows you to seek and to understand the meaning of your creek experience or of your suffering. It doesn't mean you enjoyed it. Doesn't mean you thought it was fun or good or fair or anything.
Right.
Okay. But a catastrophic deal like shouldn't be viewed as just simply, well, that was a financial loss or that was a collapse or that. But what it really is, look at it like it's a brutal tuition payment.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Survivors treat failure as a proprietary curriculum that sharpens their underwriting and operator skills.
Yes, yes. As I say, it's a graduate degree in the School of Hard Knocks.
Yeah. Yeah. And so as I was going through that, I was talking with a friend, you know, and he says, man, how do you keep your head on straight through all this? I said, well, you just said that there's a key word right there. Through all this.
Ah, yes.
See?
Yes.
So you don't stop and pitch a tent or back in a trailer or build a house and live in that situation.
Right.
You are a sojourner. You are moving through. I was a sojourner. And I think it was honestly, it was divine, but I had this, it was like an assurance that this was not the end of the story. This wasn't the final chapter. This was a step. This was a chapter in a much greater story. And that we're simply moving through this to something that we could learn from this and build to make it better. And so it just gives you a bright hope, if you will.
Yes, yes.
I tell you,
go ahead.
This is just kind of a quick aside. Like we have two daughters, they're grown.
Okay.
If I had two daughters and we're going to name them now, and I love the names we chose, right? Taylor,
right.
Chelsea, I got that. But if I had two daughters now, absolute top of my list, faith and hope. As characteristics, as personal characteristics, as attributes, as gifts of God, I don't think there are two more precious, more valuable characteristics that someone could have and could demonstrate.
True, true. I mean, of course, and the greatest of these is love, but that's a whole other thing. Because like you say, like the old joke, you know, the comedian joke, if you find that you're going through hell, keep going, you know, or since you are, of course, you know, National Association of Shit Creek Survivors, if you find that you're up Shit Creek, keep paddling.
Yes.
Don't weigh anchor. You find that you're in Shit's Creek. That's not the move.
That's right. So another great tool is to, even in the midst of all that stuff that's going on, look around. There's something in there. There's something that's a part of your story that, even though it seems like a pain in the butt now, it manifests itself later and you find out that it was extremely valuable for you.
Yes.
In the book, one of the habits I call cultivating gratitude, and I use the story of the remarkable Corrie Ten Boom. If you've never heard of her, you should read her book called The Hiding Place. Okay. These people were, believe they lived in Holland, and in World War II, they were part of the resistance underground, right? And they were helping Jews escape from persecution. And they got busted.
Oh, no.
They got busted. If you haven't read this, they made a movie of it. It's tremendous. And the whole family was split up and sent off to concentration camps.
Damn.
And she wound up there with her sister, who, you talk about wearing rose-colored glasses. You know, I mean, she was Little Mary Sunshine, right? In this concentration camp, this crucible of death. Right. And her sister pointed out, well, we need to be thankful. Are you out of your mind? Thankful? Like for what? Well, for one, the fleas. So they were in these barracks that were terribly overcrowded. They had a bunch of ladies all sleep, way too many sleeping in these barracks with no comforts, no nothing. They're all jammed together. And the place was absolutely infested with fleas. Sounds disgusting. And the sister was like, we need to thank God for the fleas. Why? She said, did you notice what's not happening in our barracks? It happens in other barracks. The guards go in and they terrorize and brutalize the people in these other barracks. Yeah? Well, they don't like fleas, the guards.
Wow.
So they don't come in here. They don't do that to us. Wow. We're free to conduct, right? We can conduct, they conducted Bible studies, they prayed for each other, they sang together, and they helped each other keep their sanity. And it was the fleas that kept the guards
away.
They
were mini vanguard.
Mini vanguards, right? So if you look through your situation, you probably got some fleas in there that seem like an annoyance.
Wow.
That seem like a kind of a pain. I'll just tell you this really quickly in our situation. So, you know, one of the fleas was the freaking investigators from the state.
Really?
Right. Well, they're checking out our company. Of course, they're going to check out the company. Yeah. We welcomed them in. We, you know, they went over everything with a fine tooth comb. I think I shared on the first episode, the lady that we met,
Marcia,
who prayed for us. Whew. Wow. Got to get through this. So after we, about a year later, she calls me out of the blue. The lead state investigator, Mr. Watkins. And this is Marcia. Marcia, oh my gosh, what's going on? She says, well, I'm doing better. I just finally got back to work. Oh my gosh, what happened? Oh, you didn't hear. No. She goes, well, of course, you had this employee who kept making accusations, and he would move from department to department with the state. But what he didn't realize was that, being the lead investigator, every one of these came back and landed on my desk.
Oh.
And since we had done a complete investigation with our whole staff, we spent time with you, you welcomed us, you showed us everything you're doing, I was able to look at this and say, there's absolutely no wrongdoing here. This is simply a product of this market. And so nothing. Clear, false. And I signed off on, I don't know, half a dozen or more different complaints, except other people had been involved before it got to my desk. And finally, the state came to me and said, what in the world is going on with this company? Nothing's going on. Yeah, well, we look like a bunch of chumps because we've gotten all these things here and we got nothing? Look, we got an egg on our face. So look, I understand that you like them and I understand they may be nice people, but nobody does everything perfectly, right? There are things that happen. It could just be accidental. It could be whatever. Find something there that didn't happen right that we can nail on them, send that guy to jail, and that way we can say, we did our job, we cleaned that up, and now that person is paying for it in jail. Wow. This is what the state told their investigator. She said, no, sir, I will not do that to these people. I've checked them out, it's clean, and I'm not going to throw them under the bus. I'm not going to make an example of them. And what you're asking me to do is not only unethical, it's illegal, it's not going to happen. I will not be part of that. They said, well, you put us in a tough spot, but we need to do something. So they launched what became a 6-month investigation into her investigation of us.
Wow. Wow.
It literally drove her to a nervous breakdown where she could not work for a period of some months. But they, when I say they, I mean the state was ready to throw us under the bus. And she stood in the gap for us and wouldn't let them in.
To the expense of her own mental well-being.
To her own detriment. To her own detriment.
That's...
And I didn't even know about this, all this. And I'm going, okay, that was about a year ago. You know, I remember a sense that there was like stuff going on that I couldn't see. But yeah. I felt like there was... like some sort of warfare or something going on that's in almost in a different realm that was beyond my perception. And that was that. And I believe God put her there because somebody else would have gone, okay.
Whatever.
Yeah, whatever. Sure.
No, my skin off my back. I'll do it. You know, that they preserve my keep my bacon out of the fire, you know, whatever.
Yeah. So putting up with all the investigations and all the everything and and treating them well, that came back and that saved us from that situation.
Yes. And if you look at it, that the genesis of that, if you will, was how you began your relationship with them. Rather than being defensive, right? It's like, you know what? Come on in. Like I say, you open the kimono. You know,
right.
This is us. This is what we're doing. You know, it sucks to be in this situation, but here we are. And what do you need? Come on in. Have a cup of coffee. You know, what can we do for you?
Yeah.
And seeing that set the polarity, if you will, of the whole connection.
Yeah.
Because she's probably sitting there thinking they were straight up. So let me. That was the perspective from which she viewed everything.
It really was. So people notice how you carry yourself through the situation, even when you think no one's watching.
Ah.
People notice. People watch how you carry yourself.
Yes.
If you act like there's something, like there's, you don't want somebody to know, if there's something you're hiding. You
right.
know, if you're not forthcoming in your answers, if you're evasive, if you're uncooperative, right? These are clues. It's like, well,
yes.
Why act that way if there's not something there that they don't want to be seen?
Right. Right. If you act like there's something to hide, people go digging for dirt.
Correct.
Yeah. And I just want to share a little thing. I've shared this in previous podcasts. In my 20s, I was attempting to be a musician on the Jersey Shore. And moved down to Jersey in 23. Now, flash forward 8 years later, I'm 31. I haven't worked in 2 years. I'm actually on public assistance. I'm on welfare. I'm living in a welfare hotel. They're paying for me to go to the local community college, and they're covering everything except for transportation. A friend of mine who was a professional bicycle racer got a sponsorship, so he got an upgraded bike, and he gave me his racing bike. The community college was 13 miles away from where I lived. So I went to school 4 days a week. So that was a 26-mile round trip 4 days a week. You know, 4 marathons in the course of a week, plus the running around. And When I say welfare hotel, it was like a cabana that was converted into a hotel on the Jersey Shore. So the room I was in, I've been in jail cells bigger than the room that I lived in. So,
jeez.
So to study, I'd have to go in the common area, which was basically the living room when this was like a private residence. And that's because I had enough room to open up my books. And I'm just heads down. Other people are watching the TV, whatever. I'm studying and just trying to put this in my rearview mirror. So I'm there one night. And I'm studying, I got the books in my lap, and suddenly there's a tap on my shoulder. I look up, and there's a young lady, we say a round-the-way girl, someone I knew from the neighborhood, probably didn't remember her name then, don't remember it now. And she says, excuse me, didn't mean to disturb you, I just wanted to say thank you. I'm thinking, thank me? For what? She says, well, we know, meaning the residents of the hotel, says, we know what you're doing, so I figured if you could do that, meaning take that trip and go through all that. I went up the road, half a mile away to the local high school, and I got my GED. Now, I was not trying to be anybody's inspiration. And to me, right. to be an inspiration meant you had to be the guy in a nice suit on the podium, you know, with the banners behind you and all your accomplishments. But as you said, I was just doing me, doing everything that I could to get out of that situation. And like you said, you never know who's watching you. And
yeah.
it wasn't because I didn't inspire her because I was better than her. She's like, wait a minute, he's in the same sinkhole as I'm in. If he can ride yeah. 26 miles a day, I can walk half an hour up the road and get my stuff together. And that stays with me. That I was 31 years old. I'm 65 now. That was 34 years ago. That will stay with me for the rest of my life. And especially when you said you never know who's watching you. You know? Like they you know they're saying, dance as if no one's watching. Live your life as if everyone's watching.
As if every yes. You and I are actually the same age.
Wow. Okay. Look at that.
Boom. There you go. Okay. So let's see. Moving on through when you know how do we make our way back? So that guy that had said, hey, I'd like you to come coach with me, right? We got talking. I was kind of working in my own space, and he said, hey, I want to in this program I'm doing, you know, for loan officers. I'm trying to get this thing done, and this is software, and it's not intuitive. I don't know how to use it. Could you? Any chance I could get you to maybe swing by and give me a lesson? He says, you do better with stuff like this than I do. He says, you just kind of go that way. And I'm like, I've never seen this software, right? when you want to do it? Yeah, sure. I don't have anything better to do that day, you know? So I go and look at the software, and it's like kind of clunky, but it was like a really primitive screen capture software.
Oh, okay.
So it's like, oh, well, you do this and it captures this and you do that. And, oh, look, you could actually bring in another little movie clip and drop it in here. So there's this little production studio that's built into it. That's kind of neat. Nice. You can zoom in. You can zoom out. You can add text. So it does a lot of stuff now that, like, Canva does in an instant, except this was like pre-Canva. Yeah, it's just like super, super clunky dunky. And so I go over and he goes, look, dude, I'll pay you for the time. He says, I mean, is that even worth it? I have to pay me. I'm thrilled. So I give him, he goes, I didn't know. So how long have you been using this software? since you asked me about it. Really? Yeah. I said, well, this, he said, I had no idea it could do all this. He said, hey, I need this to make that happen. And I did look. Why don't you come work with me? Let's like start there, and well, what else? So there were some projects we worked on. We would sit and brainstorm over them, and I would create things, and then I would step in. We'd do presentations together. He's like, you're a good presenter, you know. So I would do you know presentation and what have you, and so that really began like a 15-year
wow
collaboration. Working with this, and it, you know, it, during that time, it was like that. Not gonna lie, that company was really good for me. But at the same token, I was really good for that company.
Yes,
you know, I became like their main sales person. You know, they would just channel stuff my way, and you know, I would bring people into the program, and
you came with a strong background in sales.
came with a background in sales. So, but really, so one of the habits in the book we call developing problem-solving grit. So it's like you see something that needs to happen, rather than just going, which I could have. I don't know how to do that. Dude, what do I know about it? It's kind of like, yeah. We'll see how this goes. See where this goes. And then taking a step into the unknown. Any Disney fans out there, right? But moving into a space that I was not familiar with, but could quickly, assimilate to, and then take and convey how to do that to him and to others. We developed different software platforms. We had the very first, I created the very first online automated webinar replay system. Anywhere. They didn't exist online before. And so we had now they're everywhere. I mean, geez,
Of
you
course,
can whip stuff up and it's automatic. And we said, when we're doing this, one day this will be really easy. Right now, not so much, but we did a we took a giant step forward with that technology. We had a little platform. It was called Webinar Agogo. Webinar Agogo. Yeah. So yeah, that ran for quite a number of years. So
It's
yeah,
something, it's a
so
saying that I have, just real briefly. I say, because I do workshops with startup entrepreneurs. I don't mean startups like Silicon Valley startup, but people who like what I call accidental entrepreneurs, like I was,
yes,
like you
love
were
that.
as a result. And I say, to be successful, figure out how you can most be exploited by people who are more successful than you. And by exploit, I don't mean taken advantage of. But I mean, how you can be utilized as a resource by people who are more successful. And what you're talking about is, oh, there's no position or a staff spot. You found a way to be a utility to this person, partially accidentally. They just said, hey, can you do this? It's like, I don't know, I think so. It's like, hey, wait, you can do that. And all of a sudden, here's a 15-year relationship out of just saying, eh. Let me give it a shot. Let me see how I can be of benefit to you.
Pretty amazing when you look back at those. And honestly, that really leads into habit 10 in the book, which is just a commitment to lifelong learning. Right? People go, oh, I'm too old to learn that kind of stuff. Oh, I can't. I'm beyond all that. I'm like, we are never too old to learn something that's useful and helpful. Ever. Right? Past success, it breeds intellectual rigidity. And that was me. It's like, oh, well, this, I'm good, I'm successful at this, and we wind up closing off like the learning portal of our brain because we go, I got this nailed down and I don't need to learn that other stuff. And right.
This is my
It's,
wheelhouse. I'll stay in my lane. That's what I do. That's who I am.
yeah. Yeah. And I was, I totally fell into that. I was completely sucked into that. Except then when that goes away, you're sitting here going,
Ooh.
Okay, well now what?
Yeah. Yeah. And the danger of that is we get locked into what we do or what we've done is who we are. So then when that goes away, who am I?
Who am I? So the beautiful part is that survivors, the people who survive Shit Creek, right? They're never the most rigid experts. They're always the most educatable, is that a word? Educable, educatable beginners in the room.
Ooh,
It's
educable
like,
beginners. I like that.
yeah.
I like that aspect.
It's like not afraid to start over again. Not afraid to learn something new and come in knowing nothing, starting at ground level and going from there.
Yeah. Like the old saw goes, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
Love that one. Yeah, you need a new room.
Exactly. But I mean, that's such an excellent insight, because we're in this time, in this mindset of the cult of the expert, you know, that all we mm-hmm. have, you can't turn on YouTube or go on Facebook without seeing somebody's pitch. Hi, I'm so-and-so, and I'm the expert. I'm the blah, 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 the d-d-d-d-d, and here's my book about it. I'm the genius guy, and here's why you ought to listen to me and buy my stuff. As opposed right. to, hey, I don't know nothing, but I'm still trying. I'm still learning. And I like what you said, to be the most, not just the most educable, but the most educable beginner, to always have that beginner's mindset. It's like, I'm just getting started.
Yes. You know,
to be open, because there's so much, especially being an IT professional for 10 years less than you've been married. Lucky guy. I say that there's too much to learn, and it's always changing. There's no such thing as an expert. You can have expertise in a particular thing, and even the thing that I do, it keeps changing. You know? And we're both 65. I remember when I was in my 30s, kind of wondering, are you going to get to a point where life's just going to get boring? Where it's just going to be the same thing the next day? And it's not. And not just with my field of IT and servers and systems and web technology. I'm always amazed that I'm always amazed that there's something else or some aspect of the thing. And it's like, wow, look at this. And it's like, I've been doing this for, I know people who aren't as old as my IT career is.
Yes.
And yet there's still something. And it's not even necessarily a new emerging thing. It's an aspect of something that's always been there. But it's like, oh, wow, I never probed this deeply into this little niche or this aspect or this corner of it. And it's the same thing with life. It's like, I am 65 and a half years old, and I still wake up every day. And it's still amazing to be alive. And it's still just, life is an adventure.
Building on that, it's like, yeah, you can become an expert in something, and that will be good for about the next 2 weeks before it's obsolete, yes. Right? And here's a perfect example. Think of the people who in the last few years looked at this and said, oh, I got it. This is the next hot thing. I'm going to go get a degree in coding.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Right? Yesterday, I built a website in like 10 minutes, 15 minutes with no coding. You just go, I need a website that does this. I want it to have these features. Plus there's stuff I'm sure I'm forgetting. So put in stuff that like the unknown unknowns and the things I don't know. Right. And boom.
Oh,
here comes a beautifully constructed site. And it's like, oh my gosh. Right. I didn't have to know how to code. That would have slowed me down if I knew how to code. I couldn't have coded a hundredth of that fast, you know? So things, now, you go, well, gosh, what hope is there for us then if something like that is obsolete and a machine can do it? Well, all you do is shift. Now what you, if there's a tool that can do that, what can you create with that tool, and how much more can you recreate, and how much more quickly can you create stuff?
Yeah. Because all technology is all emerging technology is disruptive. Once upon a time, there were scribes. You had to have, you know, perfect calligraphy, and that's why they call the various typefaces, they call it a hand. And then came the typeset. So now nobody needs scribes anymore. But you now had to be a linotype operator and had to pick the things and lay up the things and the galleys and the whatever. You needed to see in reverse vision. And then came the typewriter. So now we don't need that, and you know, now it's how many words per minute can you type, you know? And then came the electric typewriter, and then came the electronic typewriter. So now your speed can increase, and you now have the backspace with the automatic corrected tape. And then came the word processor. And I remember just around when I was starting my IT career, a word processor was not just the software, it was the person, because you had to understand how to run the complex program. That was, and in fact, I remember the Wang word processors. It was a dedicated, specific hardware. And yes, that's an interesting name. Let's not go there.
That was the real name. That's right.
Yes, that was the actual name. And you had to be an operator certified on that specific thing. And then word processing became a bit of software. So you still had to have the computer that was, and then PCs emerged, and then word processing things for the PC. And now you got Google Docs, you know, you've got, you know, Outlook in the cloud. So you don't even need the software.
And you speak your message and it
exactly
punctuates it all for you perfectly.
Exactly. I remember Dragon Natural Speaking. You had to spend like half an hour to calibrate it to your speech. And now you just take out your phone and say, and maybe you might have to have some minor corrections, but the more you use it. So, but the thing is, this is still the engine of creativity. I can't turn on my phone and say, write a compelling speech.
Right.
Even for AI to do it, I have to give it the prompt about what and the subject matter and the particular things, who the audience is. I still have to define the objective, you know?
Correct.
How would I get to from New York to New Jersey on foot? I mean, I get there eventually in a day or two. Now I can drive there in a few hours. I can take the train there even less time. But I'm still the planner of the itinerary. And when I get to the destination, the train is not going to visit my niece and my grandnephew. I am. The train is just going to get me there. So all of this
Correct.
Technology, it's the vehicle, but what is the destination? Nobody wants to sit in a room with 50 other people and see some AI, here we are, and welcome to our speech, and we are now going to have a... No, no, nobody wants that. I still want to see a human being. I don't care if AI wrote your speech. I want to see you deliver it to me because I want that connection. I want that human empathy. And please don't read it like a robot.
Exactly.
If you don't have that passion and compassion, that empathy, it's going to land cold. And I don't care if you had a team of human beings writing that speech for you or if you had a thing that did it in 30 seconds. If I don't connect with the heart, and going back to why did that investigator put herself between you and harm's way to the detriment of her mental well-being? Because you made a human connection with her. Because you were open, you were honest, you were real, and she saw your common humanity. And she said, my job is not to protect the state so that we look good. My job is to do what is right, what is fair, and what is just. And I'm not going to do anything else. And at the end of the day, it's real human beings connecting with each other. You know, I'm working on my second book, which is called Born Again Capitalist. You know, run a for-profit business without sacrificing your soul. And my premise is the problem is not capitalism. The problem is we are trying to take the humans out of the economy. The economy doesn't exist for dividends and shareholders' interests. It exists for the exchange of value and energy between human beings.
Yes.
And when you replace all the people with AI and all of the workers with robots, who is your customer? Your customer's not AI. Your customer's not a robot. And if you take away all the jobs from people, who's going to be able to buy the stuff or consume the services that you create? At the end of the day, it's got to be about people. You see all of these billion company IPOs, and suddenly they have an evaluation of $200 million. No, they don't. They haven't done anything. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Stop fabricating this stock market nonsense. What do they do for people? What good or services do they actually provide? If it's not that, then it's all smoke and mirrors. And I think that's what we're forgetting. And when we get back to that common humanity and even the success of your business, was because you weren't these fintech bros who were like, hey, let me just see how many zeros we can put out there and buy crap, you know, buildings and sell them to suckers. And no, you were like people, private investors who are looking to you know, capitalize, you know, to take their money and grow it by working with people who actually need homes, housing developments that are actually going to house actual people and families so that everybody wins. There is a win-win situation. There's a win-win-win situation. And when we forget that, we're doing it wrong. That's my thesis. And I think your story is a perfect exemplar of that, both the good and the bad and the recovery, because you never lost track of your common humanity and your faith. And that is what got you through everything. That is what brought you your success. That's what got you through the failure. That's what brought you back on the recharge. And now talk about your book as we conclude things.
Oh,
give us the title
well.
and tell us about the book and how that came to be.
So a few years ago, my wife and I were out at a business conference out at Lake Tahoe. If you're not familiar with Tahoe, you know, the Eastern Shore is Nevada, the Western Shore is California. And so up at the Northwest portion of the lake, there's an old cowboy town that's been kind of redone now. It's a cute little artsy fartsy visiting place. So we went up there, had some breakfast. We went in a gift shop and somebody had made this really cool looking, you know, weathered wood sign and burned into it. It said Shit Creek Survivor. And I'm like, that is awesome. I'm taking a picture of it. You know, it's like, you know, I'm not sure where I put the thing, you know, but it's like, maybe I'll call them later and have them ship it to me or something. But I'm like, there's something that's me, you know, I've been up that creek and I survived it. Right. So I don't know what I'm going to do with that, but you know, and then, that was sort of the germination. And in early back when we were going through all this stuff, people said, oh my gosh, you guys need to put this in a book. You need to write a book. I'm like, oh, great. Wouldn't I love to read some book about somebody that just completely fell flat on their face? Wouldn't that be awesome? You know?
Yeah.
Well, I think, I don't think that needs to be what the book is about. It needs to be about how do you survive that? Right.
Yes.
So I really became a fan and a student of reading survival stories and comeback stories and, you know, the underdog stories and how that works and started noticing these patterns. So I'll just confess, you know, I'm sitting having a conversation with one of my LLMs, one of my AI engines. And I'm like, I've noticed these things. And what are some of these commonalities that people have been through incredibly difficult things? You know, like what's in common? What are some of those common traits? And like, give me 10 of them.
Okay.
Great. Here's 10 habits. And I'm like, oh my gosh, isn't that cool? All right. Well, I need to come up with can you give me real life examples of these, or is this like theoretical? No, this isn't theoretical. Here's 10 real life examples.
Ah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So that became the framework of the 10 habits of Shit Creek survivors.
Right. Right.
And so
and AI didn't write the book. It gave you the framework and the structure.
Gave me the framework. I did a whole bunch of, you know, reorganize. In fact, I'm already working on my, a second edition.
In the
second edition, kind of because I was speaking to somebody that published a book. In fact, they have 7 books published.
Wow.
And they said, hey, so on this, I like that idea. So can you highlight, maybe do you have a favorite habit, or is there one that's more important than others? Or I'm like, well, actually two jumped to mind. One is the you and I talked about this radical acceptance, stop fighting the situation,
the reality of the situation.
And start focusing on what we're going to do about it, right? I would say that one. And the second one is you got to give yourself permission to do well, to proceed and not beat yourself up over what happened. So that's the self-compassion.
Mm.
I said, yeah, so probably acceptance and compassion. And then I got thinking, well, then... If those are the ones that jump out, why do I have those listed as number 2 and number 9? Right, those should be number
yes.
That should be number 1 and number 2.
The list. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I've restructured the list. I haven't published it that way yet, but and then I was for any of you kind of would be authors out there, you're going, yeah, but I don't know how to do it. I didn't either. So I follow this guy. He's got a podcast, and he's one of these great out of the box thinkers. Anybody interested, his name is James Altucher. I'll just give him a plug. Altucher.
Okay.
Boom. And he's got the James Altucher show. And I happened to click on one day, and he was talking about how to publish your own book in the next 30 days.
Wow.
I'm like, as if. Okay. 30 days? Give me a break, right? And turned out to be a 5-part series. And in this particular series, he was talking about the types of books that people like to buy.
Oh, okay.
And so he's and how to come up with content for the books. And so he's like, you know, if you have a podcast, by the way, go back and take transcriptions of your episodes. You've got more than enough content probably to organize into a book.
Right. Right.
right? If you've got, you know, different things that you've done, different histories. He says one of the great selling kinds of books is what's called a listicle. A
Yes.
listicle is something with a number in the title. Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, you know. He says,
Right.
first listicle and best-selling ever, Ten Commandments. He goes, back then they blogged on stone tablets.
Facts.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So it was actually thinking through that. It was like, seven habits, ten habits. Oh, 10 habits. Hello. So that's kind of, but then he talked about, you know, going the normal route where you get a publisher and you create you do the whole thing. You've got to take around, shop your book, and this can be a years long process and whatever. He said, now with things like Kindle Publishing and some of the other aggregators out there, you can create the book. You can have it up on Amazon or 40 different or so other places. You have it all in there's digital, there's paperback, there's hard copy, there's audio, there's all sorts, and you can create them quickly.
Exactly. Exactly. I too am self-published.
Yeah. And using that route, you retain full control. You go through your publishing house, they're gonna choose the title, they're gonna choose colors, they'll choose book covers, they'll choose layout, they're like, okay, we got your content. Thank you very much. We'll take it from here because we know what we're doing. But that's a very long, arduous process. And frankly, you know, as I'm finding out, I'm this book hasn't led me anywhere close to retirement, you know?
So yes.
Most books that are published don't make any money. That's fine. But at least now you've got something that you've created out there. And however much it makes or doesn't make, it's typically more per book when you self-publish.
Right.
Which is a very interesting little tidbit. So Kindle Direct Publishing, KDP, you know?
Yes.
In fact, I thought, well, I'm not gonna do a physical book. I mean, I don't have the money to, I don't want to invest in that right now and print a bunch of books if I don't even know if people are interested. So when I uploaded the book, it's like, hey, you want to make a paperback? Well, yeah, but I learned that on the paperback and on the hardback, now Kindle and other places, they will publish
print on demand
on demand when ordered. Yeah, it's like, how about that? Well, another cool thing. So if you've got a book that you've been ruminating on, you can have it out way sooner than you might have thought was the case.
Yes.
So anyway, so the book 10 Habits of Shit Creek Survivors. I played with some domains. I was not able to. Somebody remarkably had taken shitcreeksurvivor.com. I'm like, well, really? What? So I went. It was some horrible little site. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I went, well, let's make this bigger than that. So I, what if there's like the National Association? Well, that's too long. National Association of shitcreeksurvivors.com. But I realized, oh, NASCS, and if it's an association.org,
right?
Boom, that was available. So I vibe coded a website. If you don't know what that is, that's
no,
one of the
yes,
platforms.
Yes, definitely do. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know you do, but
for those in our audience, yeah. Yes, indeed.
That's a platform where you just put in a prompt and tell it what you want, and it builds the site. That's one of those no code. It codes everything, and you see this and say, oh, I like this, but change that heading to this, or use this color in the background, or make this text or bigger, use the different font. You just tell it what you want, and whew, it does it.
Yeah.
And so, so it created the NASCS.org, which is National Association of Shit Creek Survivors. If you have an interest in reaching out to me, you can hit me directly, Ralph@NASCS.org. And if you're interested in the book, and it really is your roadmap through whatever creek you're involved in. And mine was financial. Others
right.
are relational. Others are health. It can be all sorts of different creeks we find
yes,
ourselves
indeed.
Up.
Yes, indeed.
And but if you hit the site, NASCS.org, you yes. see it right there. You can order the book at the site and you know, choose whatever format you want.
Yes.
And super easy.
Okay, so Ralph, your contact info is up here on the screen. You know, that is Ralph@NASCS.org. And as you can see here on the screen, for those of you watching this, for those of you who are listening in our podcast audience by audio, it's https://NASCS.org. org, National Association of Shit Creek Survivors org. You know, and so Ralph, before we go, one final thing. I noticed that you mentioned in the onboarding form that I have everyone fill out, you mentioned two names in particular. And I wanted you to just touch briefly on why you chose some of the many names. It was Viktor Frankl and Malala Yousafzai. So you mentioned that you went into your LLM and you had them give you some real life examples. And you point out here that those kind of stuck out to you. What was it about those two individuals that spoke to you?
So Viktor, you know, each of these people went through something that makes mine look like an absolute walk in the park. Okay, so Viktor was a professor, a brilliant man, and simply because of his heritage and nationality, found himself everything stripped away and in a nasty concentration camp. In fact, I think he was moved to a couple of them, and his family all taken and killed.
Wow.
In fact, he fully expected not to make this.
Right.
Okay. But he had the presence of mind, and he's the featured survivor in the Radical Acceptance.
Wow. Okay.
So, and in the Radical Acceptance, it was, I'm not saying I like this or that it's fair or that, you know, I'm ready to be happy about this. All I'm saying is that this is where I am right now, and how I that maybe they've taken away everything that like this whole place is meant to demean someone and strip them down to nothing and beat them into full submission. And he's like, you can take away all that stuff, but you can't take away how I respond to this.
Radical acceptance.
Radical acceptance. This is where I am. Each day I can choose to remind myself that I'm in control, if nothing else, but how I respond to this and know that I'm still in charge of that. So I am not broken. I am not beaten into full submission. You may, you know, stand here and club me with a shovel if I don't dig this hole fast enough. You can put a bullet in my head. You can hang me. You can starve me. You can gas me. You can do whatever. But it will be because I kept my dignity. I know who I am. I know where I am. And I still know that I'm in charge of how I respond to this.
Right.
So, wow. I mean, that is just everything stripped away, right? Malala jumped out at me. You know, this I'd never heard of her before this situation. Come to find out that she was... 11-year-old girl in Afghanistan, I believe. Yeah. And when she was 11-year-old girl, she started a blog. And the blog spoke out against the Taliban.
Yes.
Actually, what it spoke out against was the practices of the Taliban.
Yes.
And their treatment of females, the complete dehumanization of females, and... Yes. 11, right? It's not like she's 31, she's got degrees. She's 11. And this blog went viral and became an absolute sensation. So now several years have gone by. I think she's 14 years old. And, you know, she's in high school. She gets on the bus and she's ready. She's going to school. She's thinking about something. Somebody comes on the bus with a gun. Who's Malala? All the fingers point. Puts a bullet in her head.
Yeah. Yeah.
Shoots her in the head, goes in, comes out the back. They take her, they move her from there. I think she went to a hospital in, I think it was Britain or someplace like that. Radically changed everything. And rather than going, whew, gosh, I just barely survived that. I better keep my mouth shut. As soon as she was able, she resumed her speaking. And became a sought-after public speaker on this, not only for calling out what was happening to females, but for her courage to do so and her resilience. And at 17, she became the youngest Nobel Prize laureate in history.
Yes. I had the privilege. Go ahead. No, go ahead. Please continue.
I was just so overwhelmingly inspired by her story that so that's adaptability. Her chapter is embracing adaptability. And it's like, okay, this is what happened. How can we adapt? So they wanted to shut her down because she had a blog that reached out to people in that local area. And instead she became a worldwide voice for millions of women, much larger than their Weenie Little Cause over in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Yeah. And to that end, I had the privilege of subcontracting for a company that she had a shared space here in Manhattan that was primary for her organization and also for others of similar ilk. And I did a lot of tech work there, setting up their servers and Wi-Fi and connection to the internet. So I was very familiar, and I saw that name. I was like, wow. I knew her story. I just wanted you to share that in terms of how it inspired you and for those in our listening audience who aren't familiar with her. Of course, all this information is going to be in the show notes for this episode.
Each of the habits goes into a deep dive with an individual person. And honestly, each one is the best one that I could find to illustrate that habit. And why it's so important, and what can happen when people really put that to use in their creek moment. Yes.
Wow. So, Ralph, thank you. I mean, we could go on. We'd probably do an entire series of conversations. I thank you for coming back for part two, because, like as I said, your story is so rich. This episode is going to run more than an hour. I don't care. Such an inspiration, and I can't thank you enough for coming across me, as you said, by your use of AI. You just said, I want to promote my book. How do I do that? Let me find a podcast out there that kind of aligns with where I'm coming from. Oh, this failure guy. Okay, who's the
sounds
chief
interesting
contact there?
Right.
Sounds interesting. Kind of aligns with what I'm up to. Who's the guy? How do I reach out to him on LinkedIn? And here we are in our second conversation. And I'm sure it won't be the last conversation, whether it's on the podcast or just in real life.
Yep,
I am
absolutely
so happy to have met you, Ralph. Thank you so much for sharing so honestly of yourself. I mean, this is why I do this podcast. I don't care if it never becomes popular. I don't care if 20 people listen to it. As I often say, and I mean it every time to my guests, if I'm the only one who hears this podcast, I am enriched. I am edified. I am uplifted by these conversations. Your story is
awesome.
Amazing. 43 more years of blessed marriage for you. Continued success. I will put the information to your website and to the link for your book in the show notes for this episode. I encourage everyone out there in podcast land, pick up a copy of Ralph's book, 10 Habits of Shit Creek Survivors. This is Ralph Watkins, founder of the National Association of Shit Creek Survivors, NASCS.org. Check it out, because if you find yourself up the creek with a paddle, this is a guy who knows the way to clear shores, and will just advise you to keep paddling. And as I often say here on the podcast, remember, life is not a competition. And if it's a race, it's only a race that we run with ourselves. And the only person we ever have to compare ourselves with is who we were the day before. And Ralph, in his conversations here in his book, can show you how to find the way to that better you by getting rid of those negative conversations, by having compassion for yourself, by building a team, and by realizing that situations and circumstances are not your identity. Your geography is not your biography. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, to never quit, keep running. And until next time, this is Cornell Green, the Failure Guy. I'll see you on the next episode.